The Angie's List you know and trust is now Angie, and we're so much more than just a list. We still connect you with top local pros and show you ratings and reviews, but now we also let you compare upfront prices on hundreds of projects and book a service instantly. We can even handle the rest of your project from start to finish. So remember, Angie's List is now Angie, and we're here to get your job done right. Get started at Angie.com. That's A-N-G-I, or download the app today.
Welcome to the Seneca Podcast, a weekly discussion of current affairs in China, produced in partnership with SubChina. SubChina is simply the best way there is to keep on top of all the important news coming out of China. Our indispensable daily newsletter features a roundup of the news from hundreds of sources, plus links to the original pieces on our website. Sign up for SubChina Access and you get all that and much more, with stories on everything from the Belt and Road to local entrepreneurship and innovation in China, from the travails of ethnically Chinese researchers in the U.S. in this age of creeping McCarthyism, to China's ongoing extra-legal internment of hundreds of thousands, by some estimates over a million Uyghurs and other Muslims in China's Xinjiang region. We're sure you'll agree that it's a feast of business, political, and cultural news about a nation that is reshaping the world. I'm Kaiser Guo, coming to you today from the Seneca South Studio in downtown Durham, North Carolina. Joining me from the bucolic splendor of Middle Tennessee is the enviably thick-skinned Jeremy Goldcorn, better known as Jin Yumi, a man impervious to insult, invective, libel, abuse, no matter how vicious or how thickly piled on. So check this out. Jeremy, you are a beeping faced half bastard, and everything you write is spiffing. You have no idea about half the you think you about. So off, you eat a and die.
What a fucking ridiculous idea.
You see what I'm talking about? No reaction save a gentle chuckle from Mr. Goldcorn. Skin of a rhino, or maybe of a honey badger, more appropriately. Anyway, I have a great deal to learn from you, my friend.
Oh, this is ridiculous. Let's proceed with the show, sir.
Yeah. So, Jeremy, last weekend, the Financial Times ran a long-form piece titled Fear and Oppression in Xinjiang, China's War on Uyghur Culture, and it was really, really good.
It was indeed.
Yes. So the piece opens by introducing a Uyghur woman named Gulrai Askar, who lives in the U.S. now, in Virginia. A few years ago, in 2016, she learned that her 28-year-old nephew, Ekrem Yarmuhamed, had been arrested. He would later be sentenced to 10 years on what charges isn't exactly clear, but he was not a particularly religious guy. Not that that would justify a sentence, let alone such a harsh one, but not far into the piece, the reader learns that Ekrem's brother was sent to one of those so-called re-education camps, and all of our listeners have doubtless heard a lot about those. It's a bit of a long setup, but the reader learns a few minutes into the piece why that is. The reporter focuses on Ekrem and his brother and on the woman Gulrai Askar's brother, who is a translator who works on Chinese Uyghur dictionaries. The reason for that is because their arrests and detentions were really about their role, however small, in promoting the Uyghur language and the distinct Uyghur culture. So this sets up one of the first, I think, in-depth discussions that I've seen in a major newspaper about the origins and the thinking behind a major change that is now apparently underway in Beijing's policy toward its shaoshu minzu, toward its minority ethnicities, as some would translate it. And that is what we're going to be delving into today.
The author of that piece is Christian Shepherd, one of the great crop of young, tremendously talented journalists covering China these days, people with really great command of Chinese and a real appreciation for China's maddening complexities. Christian joined the FT only a few months ago, having worked previously at Reuters. Christian Shepherd, we are delighted to finally have you on the show. Welcome.
It's great to be here.
Yeah, Christian, great to have you on finally. Since it is your first time on the show, I thought maybe you could tell us a little bit about yourself. I believe you are the first international journalist, anyway, the first one I know, who actually went to school in Beijing and learned Chinese when you were really young. So can you tell us about that and how you ended up back in Beijing as a journalist?
Sure, yeah. I came to Beijing first time around when I was 4 years old.
Yeah, very young.
And I stayed here 95.
The same year as me, Christian. I was a little older.
Right.
Oh my God, I'm horrified to think.
And then I stayed. I mean, I stayed for 10 years in the expat bubble in Beijing, mostly going to international school, learning Mandarin as a second language, but you know, still being very much within that expat community. And then I left at 14, went back to the UK to this small village in North Yorkshire, entirely other end of the world from Beijing, and then did university in the UK and decided that I couldn't really stay away much longer. So I came back and did a master's degree, China Studies in the University of Nottingham's Ningbo campus, did an intensive year of Mandarin after that at the IUP program in Beijing, and then managed to luck my way into a job at the FT, originally as a researcher, helping other journalists kind of do interviews, you know, look through government websites, keep abreast of Chinese news, that kind of thing. And then I went to Reuters, did the politics beat there, a lot of human rights coverage, law, social issues, things like that, before coming back to the FT a little over half a year ago.
Well, it's great. And it's great that they gave you the room to do a nice long story like this, which I believe is your first real long form story that you've done since embarking on your career in journalism.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
Let's dive in and talk about the real point of the story, which, if I may be so bold as to presume, wasn't just to tell another story about a family that's been the victim of this draconian policy in Xinjiang, though I should hasten to add that it's a really vitally important thing to be told, but rather the point of your story is really to get into the policy change that you believe is driving this policy of the concentration camps. Is that fair? Is that what you initially set out to do?
Yeah, so when I had been reading and following and also covering Xinjiang for the last couple of years, I'd seen there had been this real focus on the security aspect of it, which obviously, as you say, is hugely important on, you know, the technology and on the camps, on the beatings, on everything like that. But I thought that there was a bit of a piece missing in some of the ideas around the assimilation of different minorities and the policy behind that that needed to be explored further. So that was my initial idea setting out.
Christian, where did you go for this reporting trip?
I spent about a week in Xinjiang. I mean, mostly it was between the capital. So I went to Urumqi for about 3 days because a lot of the family members of the people I had spoken to had been based there, either at publishing houses or government ministries. So Galore's brother, he was based at the Ethnic Languages Committee, which was you know, the translation bureau that published a lot of Uyghur Han dictionaries. And his ministry, we heard, had been essentially closed down in the process, in the same process that he was arrested, and along with some of his other colleagues. So I wanted to go and check that out. And then I spent some time in Turpan and Aksu, somewhat relatedly, following some other strands, but also because there's obviously a big difference between the smaller places and the larger cities. And then I went to Kashgar, because traditionally that's kind of the core of the Uyghur culture and where a lot of the main scholars have been based for many years.
And how much were you interfered with in this trip?
I was interfered with fairly constantly. I certainly was trailed continuously. There were people staying in the hotel, you know, in the room next to me. In fact, on the first day, I bumped into them on the elevator in the way down to the lobby. I think they were quite surprised. There seemed to be some problem with the lift and the doors opened again, and he was just there speaking into his mouthpiece, and then got in and then followed me out for half of the day. And they would you know, they would speak to every shopkeeper I spoke to. They would speak to every waiter in the restaurant where I got a bowl of noodles. At one point, there were some students in Aksu who asked to take a selfie. I think they probably didn't see many foreigners. And afterwards, the police or state security agents came up and asked them to delete those photos and question them about them. So, I mean, it was very invasive. And they also would, every time you got into a taxi or a Didi, the individual would get a phone call normally within about 10 minutes. Wow. Sometimes they would answer it on loudspeaker, so you could hear the conversation. It would be a sort of brief introduction saying they're from the local Paichusor or Gongwanbu, the public security ministry, or the local police station. And then they would ask where I was going to. If they liked the destination, then it was okay. If not, then I would be ejected from the car.
My God.
So, yeah, ideal reporting conditions. So to get at not the theory, but I suppose the policy behind all of this, in February this year on this podcast, we talked to Tashi Robge from George Washington University and Jim Millward from Georgetown about the so-called second generation Minzu policy. They talk a bit about the Soviet origins of the original ethnic or nationality policy, where certain parts of the country are designated as autonomous republics or oblasts in the Soviet case. But in China, it was autonomous regions or counties. So these counties get assigned to a certain nationality, Manchu, Uyghur, Dong, you know, Miao, Sala, whatever. And they allegedly have control over this region. But there has apparently been a big change in this. And I think, you know, to get at some of the sort of history behind this, I'd recommend readers to listen to that podcast with Tashi Robge and Jim Millward. But that conversation was a little academic at times. Your piece, on the other hand, Christian, hits us kind of in the face with a concrete example of the new assimilationist direction, which seems to be a really radical departure from the Soviet style policy. Can you talk about this new policy direction, where it grew out of, and, you know, what it means in Xinjiang today in its implementation?
Sure. I mean, one thing that probably worth stressing at the out point, which may fall into the slightly academic camp, but in theory, there's been no official policy shift. In fact, when Xi Jinping last talked clearly about this in 2014, he kind of pushed back against the idea that there needed to be a new generation. But it seems like even if officially there's been no shift, the campaigns that have been implemented are very much taken in this new generation of ethnic policy. And that new generation of ethnic policy is a term used to describe a bunch of thinkers who around 2008-2009 reacted to violence both in Tibet and in Xinjiang by calling for essentially the end to the attempt to have these autonomous regions and this attempt at a diverse nation, and instead there needed to be a real emphasis on national unity that didn't allow there to be a sense of local cultural identity to be developed amongst the different ethnic groups. And instead they encouraged things like ethnic intermingling. They encouraged the blending of different ethnicities. It was very much a move away from trying to ensure that different groups were kept separate, instead to emphasize the national identity, the so-called state race. And two of the main voices that were proponents of this, which I mentioned in the piece, were Hu Lianhe and Huang Gang. Hu Lianhe was a United Front Work Department official. Huang Gang is at Tsinghua University in the China Studies Department. And they very much were on the perhaps most extreme end of the spectrum, people calling for a new ethnic policy. And they thought that the violence that had come out in, you know, the spring of 2008 in Tibet, and then the July 5th riots 2009 in Urumqi, could very much be tied to the failure of this original policy, which had tried to give the different ethnic groups a certain degree of autonomy, although obviously not very much, but also gave them some preferential policies in terms of, you know, additional points on the university entrance exams, some tax breaks, some lighter restrictions in terms of
family planning and whatnot.
Family planning policies, all those sorts of things. They believe that these kinds of attempts had, instead of creating, I guess, the desired sense of gratitude toward the state, and instead created greater tensions. They saw that as being the fault. And so they said that instead we should treat everyone equally. But by equally, I think they meant that the state comes first. And that's why they came up with the idea of a state race.
So that's the word that you've been translating as a state race.
But it's not only the state comes first, is it? I mean, it's also Han culture comes first, really. I mean, you've documented how Uyghur bookstores, bookstores have been emptied of Uyghur books. Uyghur language signs are being torn down. It seems to have become a very specific policy to suppress any kind of expression of Uyghur culture.
I guess, and that's what I really wanted to ask you about, Christian, is so how does this go from something that's just sort of talked about theoretically by people? You didn't mention him in your piece, but, you know, the progenitor of this idea had been talking about this for almost a decade before, you know, Xi Jinping came into office, was this guy named Ma Rong. We talked about him a little bit on that February show with Jim Millward and with Tashi. But I guess I'm curious about how these ideas actually gained currency. I mean, how do these social scientists manage to attract the attention of actual policymakers? Was it like that there was a broader conversation in a public conversation about this that drew people in who actually work on and implement minority policy? Or what do you know about how this actually went from theory to practice? I mean, are we privy, for instance, to any discussions that took place specifically addressing Minzu policy, or are they in deep denial about that?
Yeah, there was a fairly open debate for a number of years from around when these articles started coming out after the violence. Obviously, Ma Rong predates this, but the real flurry was starting from around 2010 through to probably 2012, 2013. And there was a very public debate which spanned between academia and then also into government officials. The United Front Work Department official, Zhu Weichun, he kind of weighed into this and seemed to side somewhat with the second generation policy advocates. There was also, outside of the kind of more academic debate, there's kind of a rising sentiment against Islam that was sort of spreading across China. I mean, I think July 5th, the riots there seemed to spark a lot of concerns, which had rose in the years since, and that anti-Islamic sentiment, which I think has been documented by a number of different scholars, and also, you know, people like Ma Tianjie, who you've had on, who talks about this group of Marxists who kind of stoked this all online. I think those things kind of they combined together to give this, you know, sense that some change needed to happen.
Right.
And then in terms of the specific policies, you can track fairly closely between specific initiatives suggested by people like Ma Rong and actual initiatives that happen on the ground. So one thing that Ma Rong also talked about was that we shouldn't call Mandarin Chinese Hanyu, it should be called Guoyu, the national language, because you don't want to emphasize that the language spoken by the Han is different from the language spoken by the Uyghurs. It should be that the sort of the Han Chinese language, Mandarin Chinese, kind of floats above them all as the national language. And if you look at policy documents now in Xinjiang and other regions, that has been that shift. The use of Hanyu is diminished, and instead it's all Guoyu. Other things, you know, ethnic intermingling was another big theme of this second.
Are they? Sorry, Christian, to interrupt. Are they saying Guoyu or Putonghua?
Guoyu.
They're actually saying Guoyu now. Yeah.
Yeah.
It's interesting.
That's interesting because I mean, traditionally in the mainland, Putonghua is what you say. Guoyu is something that Hong Kongers and Taiwanese use. Fascinating. Anyway, I'm sorry. Do go on.
Yeah. Well, I mean, that's just one part of it. Right? So it's 国家共同语言, right? So it's the, you know, the shared national language and the policy documents now, and in fact in the schooling system, the emphasis is on that national language instead of the idea of there being, you know, multiple languages that were kind of on an equal status. Another thing was the intermingling. So there was a lot of focus on the fact that there had been a failure for this to naturally happen for the different minorities, the Han and the Uyghur, Kazakhs, etc., to all kind of gradually intermingle. And so instead, this was forced upon them, and they created unity villages, which you can now go visit in Xinjiang. And you know, that's sort of rows of pristine houses and very happy Uyghur and Han living next to each other, certainly on the propaganda tours anyway.
Even in encouraging intermarriage, even, right? When did that start, the actual encouragement of Han and Uyghur intermarriage?
Yeah, I mean, these things have all been around for a while, but there seems to have been a ramping up in recent years. I mean, you see often it's kind of a local level initiative. There'll be some directive or some official state media that covers, you know, a particular initiative that encourages intermarriage. There are a lot of these specific things going on. I mean, within the piece, I mostly focused on language and education in particular, partly because there are just so many of these different initiatives ongoing simultaneously.
Right.
But my understanding is that a large number of things that were suggested on an academic level are now being implemented practically in Xinjiang.
Yeah, so I wanted to ask you specifically about this language component of it. So, I mean, your piece, you have the officials who you do talk to are, you know, they flatly deny that there's been any connection between this discussion around second-generation Minzu policy and what's happening now in Xinjiang. And as you said, Xi Jinping, you know, is in denial about it as well. But, you know, you present some pretty good evidence. For example, in this list of intellectuals that Abdulwali Ayub, there's this Uyghur guy in exile in France, this list that he's put together, that is actually the list where your protagonist, Gulroy Askar, the woman you talked to in Virginia, where she discovers that her brother, the dictionary translator, is actually now in a camp, that he's been sent there. Can you talk about that list? I think you said something like that there was that a third of the people on it were directly involved in Uyghur language book publication. Is that correct?
Yeah, well, it's even more than that. It seems to be that about a third of the people on Abdulwali's list were specifically involved in this one case.
Oh, wow.
Which in a way is part of the core of my piece to an extent. It's that there were a series of revisions to the Uyghur language textbooks used in Xinjiang throughout the 2000s. I think it was 2006 and then 2009 were the years they were published, but this began around 2002. And this process pulled in, you know, the vast majority of a fairly small group of Uyghur intellectuals who came in, were asked by the state, who was in the process of pushing out bilingual education reforms. They were asked to renew the Uyghur language textbooks. And when they did this, the attempt that they made was to increase the number of original Uyghur sources within the textbooks in the hope that this would, you know, essentially help preserve the culture. So they wrote some things themselves. And I spoke to one individual who had actually been involved in the process, who had written a number of essays, Eset Suleiman, who now works for RFA. And then they would also try and find, you know, historic texts, poems, things like that, in the hope that these books would instill a sense of Uyghur cultural identity in the younger generation. Mm. And then around 2014, there began to be a lot of an investigation into these textbooks, which were increasingly deemed to be separatist. And then around 2016, they began arresting the individuals involved, including the father of Kamil Turk, Yalcın, who is another person mentioned in my piece.
Christian, it seems that the authorities have really decided that Uyghur culture is an enemy, and that the only way to prevent any kind of terrorist activity is to eliminate Uyghur culture. Is that what it's got to, do you think?
So it certainly seems that way from the main kind of evidence that I used to try and understand the Chinese mindset within the piece, which is this documentary produced by the Jiwei, the Disciplinary Inspection Committee in Xinjiang. And they created this precautionary documentary about the case, which is then showed to education officials and to teachers, kind of warning them against it. And we managed to get hold of a recording of this. It hasn't been released publicly.
Right.
But within that, you can see that the things that they are talking about as being the reasons for these jail sentences, which include life sentences. In the case of Yalcon Rozi, the father of Kamel Turk, it was 15 years for inciting subversion. The actual things that they are accused of, it's things like the percentage of content which was from Uyghur sources versus mainstream Chinese cultural sources. So the legislation that is cited, which I haven't been able to find, it might be out there, says that apparently if it's a minority language textbook, it only is allowed to have 30% local language sources, and these books had 60%. Therefore, that somehow equals subversion. It also talks about pan-Turkism, pan-Islam, these sort of boogeymen, which are seen to be inciting separatism within Xinjiang.
Okay, it's time to commit. 2024 is the year for prioritizing yourself. Begin your new smile journey with Byte, and you could start seeing results in just 2 to 3 weeks. Just order your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95 at Byte.com. Byte Clear Aligners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces. Plus, they offer financing options, accept eligible insurance, and you can pay with your HSA, FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
The Work Lab podcast from Microsoft answers the questions that keep business leaders up at night. Like, how can I reinvent processes for the AI era, from customer service to sales to HR? How can I prepare for AI to fundamentally transform jobs, companies, industries, and the whole economy? Don't panic. Tune in. Each episode of Work Lab brings you the top experts, hard data, and actionable insights to help you future-proof your organization. Check out Work Lab, that's WORKLAB, no spaces, on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Christian, was the arrest of the really prominent Uyghur intellectual Ilham Tohti in any way connected to this?
So I did look into that, and it seems no. It seems like his case was distinct and somewhat predated this. But, you know, I think it was more that at that time they began to become particularly aware of this problem. I mean, starting almost with Abdiveli's case. So Abdiveli tried to promote Uyghur language through private schools. The mother tongue language movement is how he talks about it. And it was you know, phenomenally popular amongst Uyghur sort of upper class, middle class sort of intellectual families who wanted their children to really have a good grasp of their language and to kind of take it beyond what the state provided schooling system seemed to allow. And then he was arrested in 2013. In that process, there started to be this discussion about how dangerous is it to promote Uyghur language. And one of the more hardline party school commentators sort of said about his movement that it was, you know, the fourth evil force. You know, they talk about the three evil forces of religious extremism, separatism, I'm blanking on
terrorism.
The third. Thank you. Yes. And so then the fourth one apparently was promoting, you know, the indigenous language. So I think that these things are all related. There was this gradual accumulation of concern within the Chinese state about, you know, Uyghur education. And then that was just compounded by the People's War on Terror and these shifts that were happening as a result of the academic debate that had been going on since 2008, really.
So to turn from the oppressed to the oppressors, another important character in the story is Chen Changguo, who is probably familiar to many of our listeners. But just in case, can you ID him and tell us about what he did when he ran Tibet and what he added to his repertoire of repression when he moved north to Xinjiang?
Sure. Chen Changguo is the party secretary of Xinjiang and has been so since 2016. And previously, he was in Tibet for a five-year stint where he developed a series of security measures. Largely, it's around a sort of militarization of essentially the whole region, but particularly large cities where there would be these grid policing systems installed, where you would have what are called convenience police stations on every block. Also, there would be systems of sort of mutual reporting where different households were assigned the responsibility of keeping watch on other households within their neighborhood and were encouraged to report upon their neighbors and people within their workplaces and things like that. And then when Chen moved to Xinjiang, the main innovation was the development of the transformation through education camps, more often known as re-education camps. And this is the system that he expanded massively. There were already some re-education camps in existence beforehand, but the scale since his arrival, it's just ballooned. And there's obviously been some fantastic reporting around that, the work of independent German researcher Adrian Zenz, and others who have gone through procurement documents to show what's being bought for these facilities. It's things like handcuffs, barbed wire, and then also just to show how large they are through satellite imagery. You know, I've seen a couple of these facilities myself on my most recent trip, and I mean, they go, you know, driving past them, it's minutes before you get from one end to the other, and there are guard towers. You know, these are sizable facilities, certainly in the same scale as some of the largest prisons you would find in other areas of the country.
So China was trying to represent that it was ramping this down, and we'd been hearing a lot of rumors about this, but Chris Buckley from The Times went out to Xinjiang to try to investigate this and did not come up with any evidence that there has been any sort of a de-escalation. What was your sense of this? Did you see any evidence that they're starting maybe to reduce the number of the incarcerated?
Yeah, I am a bit of a contrarian on this point. I'm not sure they meant to convey that they were ramping things down. The comments made by the deputy governor, he was talking about how the people held in camps had been coming and going regularly, and that he said that Duoshu had returned to society. And it's really unclear to me whether he meant, well, some people have been let out for weekends and then they go back in again, which we know from speaking to people who have been able to keep in contact with relatives. You know, that does happen. People are often let out for short periods, but then they have to return again afterwards. So I don't have any sense that there is a ramping down, and certainly nothing from my reporting suggested that that was actually happening.
So, Christian, is it your sense that this policy of assimilation is so far limited to Xinjiang and to the Uyghurs? I mean, I don't get the sense at all that it's been implemented in Tibet. I don't know about other regions, Inner Mongolia or for that matter, Ningxia with the Hui. Any sense of that at all?
The full extent of the campaign that's happening in Xinjiang.
Well, not the camps and everything. More just the push to assimilation.
Yeah, there are parts of it, right? There are parts of it that clearly are being implemented elsewhere. I mean, part of this is about the government's approach to religion, right? I mean, obviously part of the assimilation process is the dislike of the religious aspect of Uyghur identity. So there have been renewed restrictions on various kinds of religious gathering, on teaching children about religion in other areas of the country. There also seem to have been more restrictions on religious schools. That certainly seems to be more widespread. But so far, there doesn't seem to be any evidence that anything like as complete has been applied in other places, like in Mongolia or Ningxia or anywhere else.
Christian, Article 4 of the Chinese Constitution says that the state protects the lawful rights and interests of the minority nationalities and upholds and develops a relationship of equality, unity, and mutual assistance amongst all of China's nationalities. are you aware of...
That was from memory, of course, right?
Yes, that was completely from memory, because I've memorized the Chinese Constitution, because when I quote it to cops who arrest me, it's very useful in offending them off, because they're in awe of it.
It's no use at all.
Kristen, I mean, have you in your research encountered any calls or efforts to change the language in the Constitution with regards to minority policy?
No. And I mean, I think for a lot of these things, there is a real desire on the part of the party to continue to pay lip service to the idea of being the champion of minority rights. I mean, clearly that is what is talked about through all government propaganda, and you see it in billboards all over Xinjiang about how Xi Jinping cares about the rights of the individual minorities and about fostering, you know, ethnic unity, how that will lead to one great big family nationally. So I think for a lot of these things, as with the actual official denial that there's a policy shift itself, there's this desire both to hold on to the original language while also tweaking things, well, more than tweaking, shifting things very significantly on the ground. And it's, I think, the same for things like the language within the Constitution, also the, you know, continuation of using the language of autonomous regions while at the same time pushing this agenda of forced assimilation.
I can't help but wondering, I mean, whether Chen Xuanguo, you know, as he's pushing this massive program of Hanification, you know, of assimilation, whether he's studying the history of the United States during the late 19th and early 20th centuries, you know, when, I don't know if you've read about that period, but the methods that white Americans used, like removing children from their families and bringing them up in these boarding schools, not allowing the use of indigenous languages. There are definitely some parallels. I guess these days, I mean, unless you're one of these alt-right types who think that nations, you know, ought to strive to become just these pure ethnostates, I mean, you're going to look at this kind of thing as completely barbaric. Well, at least I hope you do. But do you have any sense of whether Beijing may be looking to other examples of this kind of forced assimilation, you know, into a language, you know, in particular, from China's own past or from elsewhere in the world? I mean, this kind of thing happened a lot, like in the 19th century, especially when projects for creating nation states were underway in many parts of the world. You had Great Britain, you know, the way that the Welsh were treated, you know, for a very long time. Of course, in Ireland, you know, between Acts of Union in 1800 and Home Rule. In Italy, you had it, you know, where you had all these independent city-states and territories that became Italy. They spoke completely different languages and became Italian. In France, even, you had to impose sort of this Parisian standard French on the country. I mean, I can imagine Chinese people arguing that a melting pot is somehow, you know, more just than a system that would segregate different minorities, you know, physically and disadvantage them, not having the advantage of language. I mean, that's probably the argument that they make. How do they make their case?
Yeah, well, I mean, the second generation Minzu policy advocates within academia, they very much draw their inspiration from historical examples, largely from the West. And the suggestion is that the perhaps the best aspects of what has happened in places like our own countries is that that there hasn't been this distinction between the different ethnic groups. So if you look at Ma Rong's arguments, I mean, he was always about depoliticizing, which essentially equates to getting rid of the distinctions between the different groups. So you would, one of his suggestions was get rid of the different minority identifier with on your ID card, which was something which at one stage looked like the authorities, within the United Front were also leaning towards, but obviously it hasn't happened now. But these arguments are often drawn from looking at our experience in the West. But the conclusion that seems to be drawn is that, you know, that you need to have a stronger, more united state identity rather than that you need to try better to encourage diversity. I mean, within the UK, there was for a long time talk of having a more kind of multi-ethnic society, multicultural society, and largely that was thought to have failed and to have not achieved its goals. And, you know, they draw on failures like that as a way of pushing for something that's, you know, more extreme rather than something which does more to try and preserve the individual cultural and language of the different ethnic groups.
Well, I mean, it feels like they're just too late to do this now. I mean, things have changed. Value systems have completely changed. I mean, this whole salad bowl metaphor, at least in the U.S. for sure, is won out over the melting pot metaphor. But it wasn't that long ago. I mean, I remember in the 70s when I was growing up as a kid in the U.S., on Saturday mornings, they ran these cartoons, these things called Schoolhouse Rock. I don't know if you this is this thing that Generation X kids like to remember, but one of them was called The Great American Melting Pot. If you look for it, it's on YouTube. I watched it last night when I was just, you know, prepping for this. The lyrics, part of the lyrics go, you know, lovely Lady Liberty with her book of recipes and the finest one she's got, The Great American Melting Pot. And then, you know, in the video, you just see this recipe book, which lists all these ingredients, you know, Armenians, Africans, English, Dutch, Italians, Poles, Chinese, Irish, Germans, Puerto Ricans. You get the idea. And it was the multiculturalism of the day. And then they all got dumped into this melting pot. It feels like, you know, that is extremely unwoke these days to call for that, you know, melting pot, to this sort of abandonment of individual cultural identities to this, you know, one unified nation state identity, which, you know, they the grandma in that, you know, waves an American flag but has a Kiss Me I'm Polish sticker on her sweater. But still, I feel like I kind of get how China sort of feels like, hey, you know, Mazzini and Garibaldi did this in Italy, and you know, that's what we call Italy these days. I mean, China keeps just finding itself wanting to do these things that the West did in order to get where it was, but decades or even a century, you know, later, after the West has declared these things to be unacceptable. I'm thinking about, like, you know, environmentalism, like burning tons of hydrocarbons. Hey, the West did that. Can't we do that too? Well, no, now we can't. It's from the Chinese perspective, I understand the kind of frustration at the tut-tutting that we showed to this idea.
Yeah, I mean, I think part of the criticism of what's happening now in Xinjiang, I mean, very much comes from this sense of, look, we made these mistakes. We don't want, you know, China to make the same mistakes. And you know, if you look at the use of the term cultural genocide, which, you know, has become increasingly popular to describe what is happening in Xinjiang. Some people disagree and say, well, China's trying to preserve some aspects of the culture, like the food and the dance and the what have you. So they prefer re-engineering or remolding. But others, you know, if you look back to where the term cultural genocide was originally used, it was normally to describe things like the separation of children from the indigenous group and kind of bringing them into the majority group as a way of forcibly assimilating them. Well, you can see very clear parallels there to the program, like the programs where the children of people held in camps are being sent to these essentially orphanages and then are in a fully Han environment, speaking Mandarin the whole time.
Right.
So there's definitely those echoes.
Emily Fung wrote about that, right?
She did. Yeah. She was the first one to write about these orphanages, and then as time's gone on, we've come to understand more about how this is very much part of a region-wide system that is being used. It seems to have been quite hastily built up in order to deal with the result of putting a vast portion of the population into either detention or into jails.
Christian, this is all very traumatic, but let's traumatize ourselves a little more and come back to the family at the center of the story. Can you tell us what you've been able to learn about what happened to them, to Ms. Asqua, her nephews, and her brother-in-law? And how typical has their experience been?
So the three individuals, Ekram, Bekram, who are the two nephews of Gilroy, and then her brother, Husajan, as far as I know from the last time I spoke to Gilroy, there hasn't been any change. They are all, two of them jailed, and one who is being held in the camp, that's Bahram. The situation seems to have been that they were originally, in the case of the two nephews, essentially ratted out for being too religious by a friend, a high school friend. One of the things that seems to have happened fairly early on in this campaign is that people who were detained were encouraged to talk about the people that they knew who might be breaking these new regulations about, what people are allowed to do in terms of religious practice or in terms of, holding intellectual events or holding certain kinds of books in their home. And if you were to give up certain names, and potentially your own sentence or your period of time you spend in the camps could be lighter. So it seems that the nephews were originally ratted out by this process. And then when they searched their home, they found that they had an MP3 player with recitations of the Quran, which would be considered contraband under the new rules that have been put in place.
Hmm.
And then her brother seems to have been arrested along with six other members of his department, which is a fairly small translation department. And as far as we know, they're all still in jail. One of the difficulties with reporting on these cases is that there is essentially zero clarity coming out of the policing system in Xinjiang, which is perhaps somewhat ironic given the amount of data that they collect from the populace and from any journalists they can get their hands on while they're there. So you can't really find any public records of these cases. You can visit, as I attempted to do, the places of work, but you tend to just get kind of taken on a wild goose chase. So the best that you tend to be able to get is if there's something that's posted online, if there's some sort of official confirmation of the case, and then of the occasional things that are smuggled out of Xinjiang. And so in this case, Gilroy was able to get confirmation of both the arrests and the detention of her nephew.
Man, that's really depressing. I hope that we can hear some better news about that family. But Christian, it's been just such a pleasure to finally have you on the show. I definitely look forward to having you back. So keep us posted about what you're writing so we can time it. Anyway, let's get on to recommendations. First, I want to remind our listeners that the Seneca podcast is powered by SupChina. If you like what we're doing with Seneca and with the other shows in our network, the very best way you can support our work is to subscribe to SupChina's daily newsletter. This thing is just chock full of great reads on China delivered to your inbox every weekday. Jeremy, Lucas, Jiayun, they just do an phenomenal job. They really work their butts off to bring you this amazing product, and it is definitely great value for money. So sign up, spread the word. I also want to make sure that you're all subscribed to our latest show. We're very proud of it. It's called Strangers in China. Man, there are some terrific episodes of that one that are going to be coming up soon. Okay, on to recommendations. Jeremy, you're up first.
Yeah, I'd like to recommend a podcast. It's the Planet Money podcast, an NPR show. And they have a recent one called The Working Tapes of Studs Terkel.
Oh, great.
The famous American broadcaster and journalist who I only found out about and got to discover the joys of his work after I moved here. But in the 1970s, he went around the country interviewing people about their jobs. And it's fascinating because, I mean, some of the jobs don't exist anymore, like telephone operator.
Right.
But he's a great interviewer and he gets, you know, people at their ease and he gets them to describe what they do. And it's sort of like an audio time capsule. So the Working Tapes of Studs Terkel, Planet Money podcast.
I've heard a bunch of those. Those are amazing. I mean, he was an American treasure. Absolutely. Great recommendation, Jeremy. Christian, what do you have for us?
Sure. So I have a couple of things. First is a book by my partner, Caroline Kahn, and it's called Under Red Skies. It came out earlier this year. It's a memoir and family history. Of course, I'm biased, but I think it does a fantastic job of taking you through the kind of life of a small town family as they kind of move up through the dizzying changes of the last 30 years of China's development from the village into the small town, through things like the Falun Gong crackdown, to beginning to understand events like Tiananmen, but from a fairly different perspective from the ones that we often tend to hear more from, you know, perhaps the more liberal elites. And she does a great job of walking that line between just making a picture of these people that often we tend to forget about when we're thinking about China's development. And then a second one is the work of Darren Byler, who is at Washington University.
Yes.
And does... fantastic.
University of Washington.
Yes, thank you. And he does just really fantastic writing on Uyghur culture. He has a blog called Living Otherwise, The Art of Central Life in Asia. And then he also writes a column for SubChina. But everything he does, I really think is fantastic. He recently did a piece on the use of forced labor, people who come out of the camps and then being funneled into these factories. Very detailed, very readable, really kind of gets to the heart of these issues. So I very much recommend his work.
Yeah, we're incredibly proud to have him as one of our columnists. He's just great. Absolutely. Could not second that with more enthusiasm. Darren Byler and his work. My recommendation is for a documentary film called The Brink. It's a brand new documentary by Alison Clayman, who many of you might know from her very good documentary about Ai Weiwei, the artist. The Brink, it's just a 90-minute documentary where she gets incredible access to Bannon, just following him around, you know, while he's just cussing his head off on phone calls, dressing people down, meeting with just this absolute rogues gallery of, you know, Nigel Farage, people, you know, who were close to Marine Le Pen, other rightists from the Netherlands, and going around just sort of pushing this, ironically, global, anti-globalist, populist nativist revolution of his. There are some spectacularly weird cameos by the likes of Miles Kwok, Kuo Nguyen, who Clayman actually gets to follow around in his Sherry Netherlands penthouse apartment next to Central Park. It's just an amazing documentary. I think a friend of mine, Ada, suggested that Bannon must have just underestimated her, just must have just seen her as a little girl, did not take her seriously, but this thing is pretty devastating. You should definitely see it. Jeremy, have you seen that yet?
No, I have not. I have been meaning to, though.
Oh, you'll really enjoy it.
Yeah. It's kind of one of those things, like, it's like watching Trump on television. It fills me with revulsion.
Right, and it should.
Even if I think I should know about it. I sometimes just cannot bring myself to do it because I don't want to vomit on my new carpet.
I know the feeling well. Yeah. Well, just do it on an empty stomach. anyway, Christian, man, what an honor and a pleasure to have you on, and great work. That piece was just terrific. I'm so glad that you could make the time.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Thank you, Christian.
Jeremy, as always, really good to talk to you.
Indeed.
The Seneca Podcast is powered by SubChina and is a proud part of the Seneca Network. Our show is produced by Kaiser Guo and Jeremy Goldcorn, with editing help by Jason McRonald. Drop us an email at seneca@subchina.com. Follow us on Twitter or on Facebook at SubChina News. And make sure to check out the other podcasts in our network, the Caixin Seneca Business Brief, the Pan Daily Tech Buzz China, China Econ Talk, which I must say has just been spectacularly good recently, plus two shows focused on women, New Voices and Ta for Ta, as well as the Middle Earth podcast on the culture industry in China, and that last but certainly not least, our brand new family member, Strangers in China. Thanks for listening. We will see you next week. Take care.